Today I'm talking with Stephen Dorrell, a writer and academic known for his work exposing the secrets of British intelligence agencies. He's the author of a number of books, including MI6, 50 Years of Special Operations, and Blackshirt, Sir Oswald Mosley and British Fascism. Mr. Dorrell, thank you for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
That's fine. Look forward to it.
Okay, now my listeners are likely familiar with Operation Paperclip, the U.S. government operation to bring in foreign scientists, including Nazi war criminals, to the U.S. after the end of World War II, ostensibly to keep them from falling into Soviet hands. And I understand there was a lesser-known British counterpart to this operation known as Operation Surgeon. What can you tell me and my listeners about this program?
Well, unfortunately, not a great deal as regards the files, because there's still a lot of it that we don't know about, but there has been research in this area. Like most things in the intelligence world, the Brits got there first with regard to these kind of areas. They had the intelligence on a number of German scientists. They had been recruiting people during the war. MI6 had strong links to some of the anti-Nazi groups and started to build up dossiers on some of the areas they were interested in, the scientists, new technology, etc. And immediately at the end of the war, they sent teams into Germany, and they were starting to gather intelligence, look at what the Germans had actually done. And they got there first in lots of cases, but as I said, in so many areas, the Brits had the information, but what they didn't have were the resources. They didn't have the money, they didn't have the teams of intelligence agents that the US was able to put together. So, like the rocket scientists, the Brits got there first, MI6 got their hands on them, but the Americans were able to get hold of them, offered them more money, better resources, and a better future in the United States. And this is kind of, it goes on in lots of areas of the intelligence in the immediate post-Second World War period and the start of the Cold War, that MI6 was probably the top intelligence agency, but by about 46, 47, the Americans, with far greater resources, were able to mop up a lot of the key agents, the key personnel, whether it was in the Nazi scientists, whether it was in the SAS, or other areas of the Nazi regime, who had access to intelligence or new technology.
Interesting. Now, from an article that I have from BBC News from the 31st of March 2006, UK fears over German scientists, they report that there were about 100 German scientists that ended up agreeing to work for the UK government in the 2 years preceding the World War II. Does that jive with the intelligence that you, or the documents that you've been able to see in regards to that program?
Preceding World War II.
I'm sorry, proceeding after World War II.
Yes, there were. There were people within the aircraft industry, people involved in jet engines who came to work for the British government, other areas of new technology and military hardware who came to work for the British government, and rocket areas was one. But although they got some key figures, the really important ones mostly landed up with the Americans or with the Russians. It was a real fight between them. Although we were allies, the reality was that self-interest governed this immediately after the war. The Americans knew exactly who they were after, and because they had bigger resources, it was kind of a trawling operation where they gathered up lots and lots of these people. Maybe they didn't need them at the time, but they wanted to make sure that they didn't fall into the hands of the others. And the Russians, as soon as they moved into Berlin, they were also sending out teams looking for people. So it's that old Bob Hope thing about the Russians got the better rocket scientists. Well, that's why they got their satellites up first from the Nazis. And the Brits were left with, I think, probably lower level. But if you look at that period in the late 40s, there were a number of areas where German scientists were helping the Brits, particularly in aircraft technology.
What were the terms and conditions for these scientists to be brought in? Surely they weren't just simply brought from Nazi Germany directly to work in highly sensitive scientific programs.
Well, initially, some of them went to interrogation centers in Belgium and other places, and they were assessed and screened, and then they were brought into the country. It's quite clear that people knew what they'd been up to. Some of them were involved in, like the SS, and the rocket program, which involved slave labor, etc. But that was just overlooked. They were kind of hidden away. No questions were asked about them. And I think this was kind of the heightened period of the beginning of the Cold War, where rules, regulations, moral and ethics were kind of overridden in the desire not to allow them to fall into the hands of particularly the Russians. It's pretty clear very early on that they realised the potential of things like jet engines. I mean, the British had been developing during the war but not used them. And the Germans had right at the end. And they were making a big difference to shooting down Allied planes. And so it's pretty clear what the future is going to be in terms of the technology. So, like a lot of these areas, particularly with regard to recruiting SS people who knew about Soviet forces on the Eastern Front, the ethics just went out the window.
Can you give us the background of any of those who were smuggled in these programs? Who were some of the more notorious characters associated with them?
Well, I think the notorious ones were really the ones that went to the United States. Because they took in so many, the screening wasn't so in-depth, and they allowed in a lot which were really dubious, should have probably gone to the war crimes investigations, etc., and Crow Cross, and they weren't. The Brits did take some in. They took in some of the SS people who knew about the Eastern Front and knew about some of the more obscure areas on the Eastern Front, involved in some of the Turkish campaigns, the small groups in the Caucasus and other areas where some of the SS units had wiped out numerous people. There are some academic figures they brought in. It was only years later that they discovered really what they'd done. At the time, no questions were asked. So some people were put into institutes. They set up research centres, and it's always, if you go back into that late 40s, early 50s period, you look at some of the fronts that MI6 set up, particularly to do with parts of the Soviet Union. Research always comes in the title. They set up research units for the Bio-Russians, Ukraine, the Balkans, the Baltic states. And people involved in these were often people who cooperated with the Nazis. So some of the Bio-Russians were out-and-out war criminals, Ukraine's in particular, and they were just overlooked. This was expediency. They just were recruiting people quickly. They really didn't bother about their backgrounds and what they'd done. They thought that kind of the Third World War was about to erupt. One area was tank technology. Obviously, the German Wehrmacht, their tanks were far superior to anything that the British had. And there were one or two people involved in those designs, tank armour, etc., who had very studious backgrounds because these had involved the use of slave labour, etc. They were brought in involved in the design of tanks and also the design of jet aircraft. There were a group of German scientists involved with that.
No, certainly, obviously, a lot of the military research that was going on in Nazi Germany was thus transported to Western countries and to the Soviet Union. But is there any indication? Of course, there's a lot of talk on the internet about programs like MK Ultra and Nazi mind scientists. What kind of credence do you give talk about those types of programs and perhaps possible Nazi transplantation of mind science programs?
None. I think that's a fairly pointless exercise, because the Brits were involved in areas like interrogation, deep interrogation from before the Second World War. They'd used various techniques like, the ones that now that actually sensory deprivation are used in Abu Ghraib and other interrogation centres by the CIA. As far as I can tell, they were developed in the late 1930s. And the first time they were used was actually against members of Moses Blackshirts, who were interned in September 1939. And a particular doctor, Dr. Dearden, who worked with MI5, he developed the techniques of sensory deprivation, of putting in constant light, depriving of food and water, standing up against the wall, loud noises, all those kind of things were being used then. And the British used them at the end of the war, particularly in Palestine. They had a particular interrogation center there, and they developed them throughout the late 40s in places like Malaya and Kenya, etc. So they didn't have any need of whatever the Nazis were doing, and they certainly, as far as I can tell, it wasn't an area that they looked at in any detail. The one area that was of interest was some of the Nazi doctors who had used the research they were doing in the death camps, concentration camps, to look at the survivability of downed pilots. The area of escape and evasion was very important, both to the British and the Americans. Pilots are the most expensive and important commodity when it comes to flying missions. You can replace aircraft, but you can't replace pilots. So that they looked in great detail into what the Nazi doctors had done. All these terrible experiments where people were putting coal tanks and extreme conditions and died terrible deaths. There was the debate, do you use this kind of information because it's so tainted by the connection to the Nazi doctors, or do you refuse to use it even if it saves lives? And it would appear the Americans and Brits decided to use it. And it's one of the more secret areas, really, of intelligence, the escape and evasion, because they didn't want the Soviets to know that they knew various techniques and things in the interrogation area and the use of escape and evasion. But as far as I can see, they didn't use any of the Nazi methods, because most of the British interrogation experts didn't believe them. They didn't believe in that those kind of areas. They thought they were totally unnecessary. They had their own techniques, which they had developed over time, and they thought were far more successful.
Very interesting. So you see a line of historical continuity between the techniques developed by British intelligence in the 30s and the types of techniques being used today in Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay.
Absolutely. These are not new techniques, they're old techniques. There was a conference, I think in about 1952, between MI6 and the CIA, the various experts and a number of academics came together to discuss ideas on interrogation, brainwashing, etc., partly in the light of the Korean War. But also they were using the experience they got from the Second World War, and the Brits said, basically, there's nothing you can tell us on this, because we think we know what we're doing, and we think we're the experts on this, and we've been doing it for some time, and we know what works and what doesn't. They did start to use LSD about that time. The British had been using it from about, I think, 1952 is about the first time that they used it. They were using it on various service personnel. But I think they used it in the interrogations and things. But it wasn't, as far as I can tell from the very limited information we have, it doesn't appear to have been a great success. Sorry. They did look at other areas, hypnosis, etc. But again, I don't think they regard it as a great success. There are indications in the late 50s that they were using some of the more sophisticated techniques or technologies. I don't know if anybody's read Mark Steen's fiction book, The Cooler, but that was based on actual events and places. There were what might be termed, or what are termed, rubber rooms, where black returned agents from the Soviet Union had come back, were interrogated, and they used drugs, in-depth interrogation and things. And there were a number of secret places around the country. There was one in Scotland, and Mark Steen based his book on that, and of course The Cooler then became the basis of the cult TV series The Prisoner. So although The Prisoner's kind of pure fantasy on one level, it actually has some basis in reality.
Extremely interesting. Getting back to the topic of Operation Paperclip and Surgeon, those programs were quite limited in their scope and nature, limited to the scientific aspect. But what can you tell us in broader terms about ties between fascists and intelligence agencies like MI6, both before and after World War II?
Before I get to that, those are just two of the operations. There were numerous operations going on, in fact. I think one of the most interesting ones is kind of the overlap between business and intelligence in that period. Number of teams went into Germany looking at like chemical processes, high technology and things. One of the interesting areas, of course, is that they were shocked by the huge developments that the Nazis had made. Despite the intense bombing, they walked into factories where they discovered, like, lathes, machines far advanced to anything that they had at that particular time. And the quality of German engineering and manufacturing was far superior to what both the Americans and British had. And so that was another area where they took in people. There was one reason, of course, why Germany was able to bounce back so quickly in economic terms. But there were lots of different areas where these small intelligence teams, often made up of special forces, intelligence officers, specialists in different areas, were going into Germany looking for specialists across a wide range of areas. But also, of course, when they went in, the intelligence agencies, they were already planning for the next war. I think by the summer of 1944, the British and Americans believed that actually the next war was on the horizon, and that they were going to have to plan for a war with Russia. I think they expected, or some sections expected, the Russians to take Berlin and then march on to Paris and to the coast. I don't think they thought they would stop. And even if they did, they expected that, given the successes of the Red Army, that in fact there would be another war on the horizon. So the intelligence agencies were already planning for that on a small scale, and went into the occupied or previously occupied territories, started to resurrect their intelligence networks, the rat lines which had been used to take out Allied pilots and people out of Europe and turn them around into anti-communist networks. So one thing that came out of that was the desire to recruit Nazi intelligence people very quickly, particularly those with knowledge of the Eastern Front of the Red Army, of the Russian Air Force, etc., and their knowledge of the Russian intelligence service. So there were teams going in searching for these people very, very quickly. By 1946, they had set up networks of former SS people, including the notorious Klaus Barbie and others, and set up networks basically in anticipation of another war.
Now, again, one would assume that intelligence agencies that were going into Germany to raid for Nazi intelligence agents would be doing so in an effort to, of course, get them to interrogate them about what they might be able to tell about, for example, Soviet intelligence. But is the implication then that they were actually working and colluding with these people?
Oh, yes, very, very quickly. They did take in a lot of people. They did interrogate people. I think some slightly unfair to believe some people, they were recruiting, you know, hundreds of these people, and they were just letting them by. They didn't look into their backgrounds and interrogate them. But there were, in fact, major kind of war crimes inquiries going on, and the intelligence agencies were also involved in that. Even though some of that was rather a dubious nature, we know that MI6 had their interrogation teams looking for war criminals, not just to recruit them, but to actually prosecute them. They did have interrogation centres, particularly an offshoot of MI6 called M19, which was involved in escape and invasion. They were involved in the interrogation of senior SS people. Some of that was dubious, and in the 46-47 period, there were a number of deaths during interrogations. Conditions were terrible, and these weren't the kind of traditional British intelligence interrogations that we might see publicised. These were kind of fairly brutal affairs. So on the one hand, they were pursuing the war crimes thing, but also they were also looking for people that they could recruit into what became known as the stay-behind units. Units of specialists, special forces, intelligence people who would remain in place when the Red Army moved across the border into Western Europe and would set up intelligence and networks and also guerrilla networks to fight behind Soviet lines. The background of some of these people was known. The background of Klaus Barbie was known. But at the time, and again, you know, kind of ethical, moral considerations just went out the window, and they went ahead and recruited these people.
Now, for my listeners who might not know, how did the stay-behind operation that was supposedly to fight the communists when the invasion happened, how was that eventually put into operation?
The stay-behind operation is a very, very big story. I mean, it sent, well, it goes across the whole of Europe. Almost every country in Western Europe had a stay-behind unit. These were set up either by MI6 or the CIA. Europe was split up at some meeting where the CIA officers and MI6 officers decided on a strategy to organized these stay-behind units, and CIA took a number of countries, particularly Italy, and MI6 took some of the other countries, particularly the Scandinavian countries, and they set up their own networks. MI6 based them on people they used during the war, and the individual countries also, their intelligence agencies, set up their own networks. It's often the case there might be three or four networks within one country because nobody trusted anyone. These involved different areas. There would be kind of the traditional guerrilla unit, and a number of points within the country would have secret depots of arms, etc. Often these would be in the countryside, in remote areas, which could be supplied by parachutes or arms drops, as had been done during the Second World War. There would be propaganda units. Sometimes there would be secret stations for radio and even later TV. There would be escape and evasion units to help bring back downed pilots and other important personnel, etc. They varied from country to country in terms of the politics and what they actually did. Obviously, you know quite a lot about Italy, where the recruitment of former fascists led to trouble in the 70s with the strategy of tension, whereby some of these units were used internally to put down the communists and to prevent the Communist Party coming to power. Other places, such as Holland, they're actually kind of a social democratic makeup, had little involvement at all in domestic affairs, were very secretive and just kept in the background. They're probably more prominent in France, but not to the extent of Italy. But also some of the neutral countries. Switzerland had a unit set up by MI6. Sweden had a unit set up by the CIA. And these were amongst the most secretive parts of the intelligence agencies, and we still know, little about what they actually did. They were activated at various times, particularly in 1956, the time of Suez and the Hungarian uprising, and again at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The whole network was put on alert, fear that there was going to be another war. If that had taken place, then people had been recruited, and these might be, say, in Austria, they might be shepherds who knew the passes, they knew the mountains, may have worked with intelligence agencies during the war. They would be activated, they would start digging up the weapons. There were hides, secret places they go to, the communications network would be activated. And small teams of special forces from the CIA and MI6 would be parachuted in. It was, as I said, activated at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Everybody was put on alert, but I think that's as far as it went.
Can you expand on that term, strategy of tension?
It's really a French idea, psychological operations, that... they use the term intoxication, kind of intoxicate the situation. Pardon me. The great fear on the Italian right and amongst the CIA and State Department in the, going back to the late 1940s with the election, and then into the 50s, was that the Communist Party, which was growing, would eventually gain power. Sometime in the early 60s, the Stabiliar parties in Italy were moved away from just being in the background, in secret, waiting for the war. They were turned on the communists. And in the late 1960s, you see a number of explosions, bombings, which were alleged to have been by the left, but we now know were actually carried out by extreme right elements. They were creating this strategy of tension, which would force the army, the authorities to intervene, and maybe even arrange a coup d'etat against the Communist Party. And so there were a number of incidents which kind of intoxicated the situation, increased the tension, and they, in a way, they managed to succeed in that they didn't. The Communist Party didn't manage to take over. They came very, very close.
Now, to be clear, what kind of kinds of incidents were staged to take part in the strategy of tension?
Well, the most famous one is the bombing at Bologna, which was carried out by extreme right-wing elements and fascists linked into elements of the Italian intelligence service, a particular unit within that which dealt with stay-behinds and what was known as Gladio. That linked in also to political elements around Gelli and P2, the Freemason outfit.
Let's switch tracks slightly here. On the internet, your name is associated with the term parapolitics, and I'm wondering, is this a term you use yourself, and if so, what is its scope and definition?
Parapolitics was a term invented and developed by Peter Dale Scott, who's a professor at Berkeley University. He'd been looking at the Vietnam War, and he was interested in the crossover between intelligence agencies and domestic and foreign policy. And previously, intelligence agencies had been regarded as kind of a separate unit, self-enclosed, self-contained, and that the politicians drew intelligence from it, but there wasn't really a crossover. So he began to look at that, and the obvious climax of that, really, was Watergate, where you saw the involvement of intelligence personnel in domestic affairs. And parapolitics kind of developed around that period. And originally I'd looked at American politics. I'm very interested in American politics, probably knew more about it than I did about British politics. But in the early 80s, I decided that this was a bit silly and really should be looking at British politics and the involvement of British intelligence, MI5, MI6, etc., and were they involved in any way in domestic and foreign affairs here. And it soon became pretty clear that they were, and I started to look at the 70s and the alleged plots against Harold Wilson, the British Prime Minister, and you immediately saw the role of key intelligence personnel in that plot, both people within the services, but also people who had left, retired, but were still working, and also private groups, security companies, think tanks, etc., which involved intelligence personnel. So it's developed quite a lot now, and what you see is that old idea of these separate, self-contained agencies isn't true, and I tend to see things in terms of factions. That the CIA is a massive organization, bigger than any other intelligence agency in the world. It isn't just one body. It is made up of different areas, and often within these different areas you might see different factions. The most obvious one in the past was probably the area of counterintelligence, where you saw a faction around James Angleton, which was extremely right-wing, paranoid, and very, very anti-communist. And there have been more liberal elements within the CIA opposed to that.
Certainly, I think it's valuable to look at the factions within the intelligence agencies and how they might be playing against each other as much as working with each other. And in that regard, could you speak to the idea of compartmentalization within intelligence agencies and how agents might not even be aware of other parts of their own agency?
I think that's a really good point. Intelligence as an area for study has become very big. It's one of those, quote, sexy areas that has developed quite a lot and is very popular. But they still tend to treat it very much like you were studying diplomacy, State Department, or whatever. And there's quite correctly a reliance on the documents, but intelligence isn't like diplomacy. A lot of it is carried out in corridors. There's very little actually put on record. And from what we know of intelligence records, often they are shaped in the knowledge that in somebody like me in 20, 50 years is going to read them. And so they are already shaped with that kind of view for public consumption. And within the agencies, they are very calm, very much in these discrete little units, compartments, whereby for security reasons one section won't know what another section is doing. But that creates within these organizations this high level of secrecy, which is often counterproductive, and they don't talk to one another. And again, you can see that very clearly with the Angleton period. And we know that some sections were talking to the others, and within those sections they kept private files, which weren't available to other people, and Angleton even had kind of third files secretly stashed away in his own safe, which he didn't show even to some of his closest colleagues. So it's sometimes very difficult to get a view of an intelligence agency when it gets to that size of the CIA, because there isn't simply one view that is coming out of it. Angleton was so powerful that he was able to impose his own view of the world on different areas of the agency's work.
Very interesting. Obviously, this is a difficult field for outsiders to research, and I understand that there was some MI6 interest in your book on MI6, and apparently, according to the reports I've read, the book was cleared legally by the publisher because your book was based on open source documents. And I'm wondering, do you rely solely on open source documents for your research?
Not solely, but yes, I can't put a figure on it, but as I argue in the book, there was far more in the public domain that we were aware of. Nobody had really attempted a history of MI6 in the same way, because they were put off by the idea there's no information. MI6 simply doesn't release records. I mean, it's difficult with the CIA, but the CIA has released quite a lot of records over the years, particularly in the area of counterintelligence. There was a huge number of records now, particularly, say, from the period of the Kennedy assassination, which are very revealing about the way that the agency operates. MI6 is nothing. But I've been doing this for a fair number of years and collecting material, and I knew that it would be possible. But even so, I was surprised in some ways the amount of material that you could collect. And I think this is a problem for any secret agency. If we live in the kind of world that we do, kind of globalized, information, the internet, etc., mass communications, then it's impossible for any agency to remain secret. And a lot of the work of intelligence agencies is actually above ground. It is in the public domain. They do talk to the press. They do talk to inquiries. They have to. They have to present their view of the world, particularly in this era of counter-terrorism. And in the process, a great deal of material does seep out, and you can start to put this away. And it's like putting together a big jigsaw, really. It's bits and pieces, gradually building it up. And since, I mean, that's probably 10 years, really, ago that I kind of was doing that. And since then, a great deal of more material has come out, the inquiries into particularly weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They would force the intelligence agencies to reveal quite a lot about how they operate and what they do.
Fascinating stuff. And as you indicated earlier, parapolitics is a growing field of research. And as such, who are some of the researchers or writers that you feel today are doing important work in this field?
Mark Curtis in this country, he's very good. He's had a couple of books out on British foreign affairs. He's delved into the archives. And again, there's much more material coming out there. When I was doing it, there was very, very little. But freedom of information that we now have here, the release of more documents has meant he's been able to do that. And I recommend his books. obviously, the doyen of all this is Seymour Hersh. It's still remarkable how he manages to keep it coming out with this material. He is the best because he has better sources. There isn't anybody in Britain that I know of that has the kind of access to sources that he does. In general, I think the area of investigative journalism is in a very poor state. There is not a great deal of original work going on. The newspapers just don't give the money out to do it. There's very little on TV, there's some on radio, and a lot of the internet stuff is really recycling other people's work. It hasn't yet really developed a kind of investigative journalism skills that are required. It's incredibly useful for a lot of information and documents and things, but there's a lot of people who call themselves investigative journalists, but they're actually not delivering the work, I don't think.
I assume you are familiar with Hirsch's latest article from The New Yorker, which came out this week, I believe, on the build-up to war in Iran.
I was aware of it. I haven't actually read it yet. I've read his previous ones, and they're always interesting because you do find out stuff about Britain, which you can't actually find out here.
Very interesting. He must have some good sources indeed. Mr. Doyle, can you tell us a little bit about your own work and where people can go to find out more about your work?
Well, my next book is on British intelligence in Ireland during the during the period of the Troubles, 1966 to the present day, which people might have thought would have been covered fairly well, but in fact it hasn't, so I'm hoping to kind of open up some new fields there. But it's been interesting and difficult to do, in fact, because I'm kind of... so much information coming out. Numerous inquiries have been taking place, official inquiries into bombing incidents, etc., assassinations, and there have been lots and lots of documents. So it's an area where, for once, there's actually kind of some documentary evidence to have a real go at. And then I'm doing a book on Gladio and the Stay Behind units, which comes out of my MI6 book. There was a lot of material there which I couldn't actually use. I mean, it was a big enough book as it was, so I did actually cut material out. And I'm also working in the area of MI6 and the use of journalists over the last 50 years. The recruitment of journalists and people in the media, both as kind of full-time agents and as agents of influence.
All three of those are extremely interesting subjects, and I don't know about my listeners, but certainly I myself would be very interested in reading on those subjects. What kind of timeline are we looking at for these books?
The book on Ireland should come out the end of next year. The following year, I'm hoping that the Gladio book will be out. It's almost written. And an updated version also of a book on the Profumo Affair, which was the first book I did in the middle 80s. New materials come out on that. And then, where are we? So, I think it's 2010 when book on MI6 and journalism comes out.
Excellent. Well, I'm very keen to see that. And do you have a website that you could direct my listeners to?
www.rogerdog, all one word, rogerdog.co.uk. It lists my books. It's not terribly well developed at the moment, but we will do that in the future.
That's a very evocative name for a website. How did you arrive at that?
It was my dog, Roger.
I see.
He was an investigative and. He liked to investigate things. So it's kind of in memory of the dog.
Very nice. Well, Mr. Doyle...
Also has some photographs of the last... gig by the Sex Pistols, if anybody's interested in that.
Well, something of historical relevance there. Mr. Doyle, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure, and I could talk to you for hours more, but in respect of your time, I'll let you go. But thank you very much for joining me today, and I certainly hope that we can talk to you again in the future.
Okay, enjoyed it. Thanks.